so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, it's time for another toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How are you, sir?
I'm in recovery mode.
I feel like I'm permanently in recovery mode lately. I feel like I've been in like a week-long at least recovery mode.
Well, I only turned 35 like 2 months ago, so this may just be the new normal.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. Guess what? It's the new normal, but it gets worse. How's that?
Well, thanks for nothing.
All right. So as we record this, it's Wednesday afternoon, and we are mere hours away from the conclusion of this year's baseball season.
Dun, dun, dun.
Are you feeling nostalgic for 2016 baseball already? I kind of think I know the answer to this.
No.
I will stop thinking about the 2016 baseball season approximately 11 o'clock this evening, I have a feeling.
Yeah, I expect my last thought, right around there, 11 Central, 9 Pacific.
Yep.
That's, you know what, that's not true. If I will have thoughts tomorrow about baseball, the day after it ends, but they will be thoughts about people, you know? They will either be thoughts of disgust at the people of Cleveland for owning two championships simultaneously, which seems like a horrible wrong in the world that we can't allow to happen. Or I will be happy for my Cubs fan friends.
I have a feeling I'll be thinking about old ladies either way. You know what I mean? Like old ladies who...
No, I certainly don't.
You're right. That was a leading sentence. But like they're, you know, like let's say the Cubs lose. They're going to be like a lot of 85, 90-year-old ladies in Chicago who are going to go, who are sitting there thinking that I will probably never see the Cubs win the World Series. You know?
Yeah.
And if they win, there's going to be lots of 85, 90-year-old ladies in Chicago who are like, I waited my whole life for this, and now it's here, and I can die. You know? So.
Wow.
Old ladies, okay. Either way.
Well, I don't know why you're trying to kill old ladies, but okay. I mean, to me, that's the takeaway so far from this podcast. Derek Madden killing old ladies. But you know, hey, look, you do you.
That's all I can do, man. All I can do. Is there anything that you are do you have any takeaways? Is there anything you're really hoping happens tonight?
I'll start with the first one. I have one takeaway from this postseason and this season in general, and that is if you hate the Cubs, I'm sorry, because this is going to be going on for a while.
Yeah.
This team is dynamite. They are stacked beyond belief. And the sheer quantity of quality talent that they have, in a lot of ways, I feel like every GM in the league should be embarrassed.
Yeah.
And maybe not every GM, because the Cubs do have a big bankroll that they can work with, and that's certainly an advantage. But
I mean, are they spending all that much money? I mean, I know Jason Hayward was expensive, and
they're allowed.
Lester is expensive, right? That Lester's making a lot of money. That's kind of it, though, isn't it?
I think Arrieta may have gotten an extension for a few bucks, but it's more.
But they didn't spend a lot to get him.
Operating your franchise with impunity as it regards finances allows you to do things that the Cubs have benefited from, I believe.
Sure. It does make you wonder, you know, if you're a Bay Area fan, why the Giants aren't a little more spendy.
Well, let's put that aside, because there's a lot of questions you could ask about the Giants, but that's really for my other job. The simple fact of the matter is there is no team in baseball that even – is in the same ballpark as the Cubs in terms of organizational quality and depth right now, at least as far as I can tell. And admittedly, I'm not a great expert on like the Astros, which seem like one team that might be in that discussion. But the youth and talent So many guys still under team control. And like we just said, they've got all this money. They can basically re-sign whoever they want. And they can let Jason Hayward either let him go or let him sit on the bench making $30 million a year because they have that financial flexibility. This team is going to be a terror for at least the next 5 years.
Yeah.
At least.
I mean, it's interesting as a team that is rooting for a team that's kind of headed down that Braves or that Cubs Astros path. Like the Braves are just attempting to stockpile as many young quality prospects as they can and hoping that enough of them pan out so that they have a team like this moving forward. And it'll be, you know, it's interesting to see if, you know, 3-4 years from now they can turn into this kind of team, because the Cubs were, 100 game losers not that long ago.
That's right.
But, look, there's going to be a lot of, especially if they win, there's going to be a ton of Theo Epstein takes tomorrow. Can you say if he pulls this off that he's the greatest general manager of all time?
I already think he is. I don't know why you would even argue that.
I mean, he's got to be in that conversation. It's pretty the body of work is pretty ridiculous at this point.
Here's the real question in my eyes. Here's the real question, and I can only think of one name. Who else is in that conversation?
Who else is? That's a good question, actually. Who else? I think John Schuerholz would certainly be in that conversation.
Yep.
And then after that, who was the? Who's the author of? People don't really look at Brian Cashman the same way, right? Because everyone just felt like he had so much money to play with.
Yeah, but I think that's a bit of a misnomer, because when the Yankees were winning, and I'd have to look and see when Cashman started, but when the Yankees won a few titles at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, they were doing it more with, one or two big names and mostly homegrown talent. I mean, I can't even remember their stupid names at this point, but obviously like Bernie Williams and Mariano Rivera and Jorge Posada and even Jeter, who, seems like a big money ad because he's Jeter. He's a Yankee prospect. Pettit, those guys. And then they were filling in the blanks with Paul O'Neill and
Alex Rodriguez. But
A-Rod only got the one,
They spent a lot of money.
They did, but I don't think the spending of the money was actually very successful.
No.
So if it was Cashman who built those earlier teams, he's still not in the conversation with Theo.
Right. I mean, look, the problem is the GM didn't really become a celebrity or a valued part of the organization until, maybe 30 years ago, right? Like
that's part of it.
You couldn't say who the classic the 1950s and 60s Yankees general manager was. No one knows, right?
But they didn't have free agency, and they had like 10 teams.
Yeah.
So I think the conversation about best GMs starts in the 60s and 70s.
Right. It's Schuerholz and Theo at this point, right?
That's what I'm saying.
I don't know if I can think anybody better.
No. And there's three or four, I think, GMs in the Hall of Fame. But to me, Theo is a first ballot shoe-in. I don't know how that works. I don't know how he gets on the ballot, but – what the guy has done is unbelievable. And by the way, when he left the Red Sox, they had just as good full-on top-to-bottom organizational health with quality big leaguers, some of whom were making big money, and quality guys coming up through the system. All the dudes that have come up with the Red Sox, Pedroia all the way down to Mookie Betts, like those are Theo guys, basically.
Yeah. Here are the four GMs in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Branch Rickey, who I actually do think has to be in this conversation.
It's a different conversation.
It's not just about Jackie Robinson with him, though.
That's mostly what it's about.
And Larry McPhail, Ed Barrow, and George Weiss. Those are the four GMs. So no modern day GMs.
Now, I've never even heard of the last two. Obviously, Branch Rickey, Jackie Robinson et al. Is a shoo-in. Larry McPhail, I know a little bit about, but my guess is that those guys get in as like influencers more than as general managers per se, the way we think of a general manager today. Just because, again, it was a very different job without free agency, and just like things were very different when those guys were doing this. So to me, if we're talking about in the wheeling, dealing free agency era, Theo stands above in my eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, Sheerholtz is great, but it's the second – going to a second place and doing it this convincingly.
Well, but Sheerholtz did that. He's very successful in Kansas City before Atlanta.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
I don't know his Kansas City history. Is that George Brett?
He was the architect of some of those, you know, 80s Kansas City.
So, yeah, maybe Sheerholtz is in the conversation. Obviously, my knowledge of pre-90s, pre-80s GM stuff is minimal.
By the way, 71, I believe, was the last time any GM was elected to the Hall of Fame. So.
Right. So that's what I'm saying is modern GMs – I can't think of anyone that goes in the class of Sheerholtz and Theo.
Yep. He was the GM of the 85 World Series champion in Kansas City as well. There you go. All right. So, yeah, Theo's great. Here's my last –
By the way, I think both of the managers in this series are Hall of Famers as well.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Particularly if – I mean, I guess it'll be the second win for Francona and be the first for Madden.
No, I think it's – right? It's not the third.
Third win for Francona? He had two with the Sox? Sorry.
Thought he did.
Okay, so fair question about the baseball. I was coming in here and SportsCenter was on, and they were talking about Warriors Thunder tomorrow night. On the day of the World Series, you know, they're spending their time on a basketball game the next day. Which of those two are you more excited for?
I'm more excited for Game 7 of the World Series. That's a ridiculous question, but I am very excited about Durant v. Westbrook as I'll be calling it, apparently. But I got to say, you also need to note this is not even an ESPN game. You know, you might expect that if it was going to be on ESPN,
yeah,
but if it's a Thursday night basketball game,
TNT.
I believe that means a TNT game.
Yeah.
So they're hyping somebody else's basketball game. I mean, granted, it's someone else's baseball game too, but it's Game 7 of the friggin' World Series, man.
I
know you got to have some other programming, but cover the hell out of it.
To me, that's a comment on modern sports media because I think that what they're most interested in, especially
the
on
drama.
these news shows now, yeah, is the soap opera and the drama. And there's no better drama, right, than Russ versus KD. With the Warriors in tow, right? Currently going, there's no better.
Unless you consider, right, unless you consider a baseball game that decides the fate of the season between two teams that haven't won in 50 plus years, dramatic, you know?
No, I hear you, but narrative like, beats game results
about?
In modern sports media, doesn't it?
But how is that not? But that is narrative. There's so much narrative there. They could be showing billy goats and friggin' all sorts of crazy stuff all day long. It's to me, there's nothing more dramatic than a Game 7. I mean, I've said this. Game 7 is the peak of sports. Game 7 of a championship series is the peak of sports. And frankly, it deserves narratives to be built around it, and there's plenty of places
so many
to do
narratives
that
in
with
this game.
Matchup. So.
I'm not trying to argue that point. I'm just trying to accurately represent ESPN's position.
I don't know what their damn position is. To me, that's silly.
You know, I mean, I think all things considered, they'd rather be talking about who's going to start a quarterback for the Cowboys next week, right? That's probably what they really want to be talking about. More than any game.
It is surprising. As much as baseball has waned, as much as it's flagged in popularity, it's surprising to me that, again, Game 7 of the most dramatic World Series I can remember is second fiddle to a Game 5 of the regular season of an NBA game, or
it's a little
whether
weird.
Or not Tony Romo is starting.
It is a little weird.
I don't get that. I don't know why that is. And it seems it's surprising to me if it's the case that the country and sports fans actually would prefer to hear about that interpersonal drama tomorrow than today's gigantic actual sports game. That I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah, it is worth noting that Game 5 went directly against the Cowboys and beat them by about 30%.
Well, there you go.
So I
think that's what I'm saying. I think ESPN is missing the damn point.
Yeah.
I think they're doing it wrong.
That'll be the first time in human history, right? ESPN done did it wrong. All right, let's move
like
on
the to. Thing to do, wrong.
I mean, they have employed Chris Berman for the last 10 years.
That's still going on. That's the thing that's still happening.
I know. Just for a couple more months. Half.
Wait, what?
Right, he's retiring.
He is?
Yeah, this is last year.
Oh, sweet glory. Hallelujah. I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that why they're like tossing him some baseball games here?
Yeah. It'll soon be safe to watch Monday Night Football halftime again.
Boom.
Rumbling, bumbling, stumbling. All right. Yeah. Let's move on to Black Mirror. well, we can. Episode two, playtest of the new season.
Oh man,
have you been talking to anyone like in your regular life about Black Mirror?
Yeah, I'm not sure we've gotten to playtest though.
I have. I've got a few people into it. The response is universal. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. I have not. Everyone I've turned on to it has, at worst, been very impressed and disturbed. But almost everybody loves it.
Yeah. And it's and they're hooked, and it's I'm getting the sense that maybe it's catching on, and that this Netflix exposure is doing the trick, and that would make me very happy to be able to talk about these episodes at length with all sorts of random people, you know.
Yep, totally.
All right, so episode two, playtest. This would be, I don't know, would you call it the video game one?
I don't know. I would call it. It jumped straight to the top of my most disturbing list.
It's certainly to me the most kind of like a traditional horror movie of all the episodes, at least that I've seen.
And
so
you
far.
You said that, and I kind of thought about that, and I'm not totally sure I agree.
Really? Which one would you say was more like White Bear?
Well, okay. I guess I didn't really think about it just from the most perspective correctly, because they're not really, most of them, they're not very horror movie-ish.
Right. I mean, you got special effects monsters in this one.
Well, right. So it has like that trope of horror movies, and it has a central character who is scared, you know?
Right, and not understanding whether what they see is real or not, and terrified by it. Those are serious horror movie tropes.
It has those base aspects, certainly, of a horror movie, but also it's much more, I don't know. These are so much deeper than horror. Like horror to me shakes you in a sort of like a surface way. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's just not. I don't know. To me, these are so much deeper and more thoughtful. And I'm not a big horror movie guy, so I may just be inappropriately disrespecting horror movies.
Yeah.
But when I think of a horror movie, I think of like a thing where I'm scared in the theater and then I leave.
Do you think of a thing where the protagonist is lying on the ground screaming, stop, 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 get it out of me, stop? Because this kind of had that.
Yeah, maybe. But when this episode ends, and we are going to spoil it,
I probably should run through the plot real quick, actually.
Let's take a quick step back. Short version, a guy who is traveling the world after his father passes away of Alzheimer's, right? Do I have this right? His father gets early onset Alzheimer's. He passes away, and this young adult man takes like a backpacking trip around the world. Ends up in London or something, somewhere in England, and meets this girl, has this, cool, fun night with this girl, and then somehow gets drawn into being a tester for a video, a hot new video game thing.
Yeah, he's got like an odd jobs app because, it's what people who are backpacking through Europe who want to make some money. It's a popular app with those people.
Right, you pick up an odd job here or there.
Yeah.
And this odd job is testing a video game that turns out to be like an implant that sort of projects an experience onto his brain that he experiences as reality. But it's kind of an inception-y, and ultimately he like thinks he pulls out and wakes up out of these video game dreams on a couple of occasions, but really ultimately he dies, his brain seizes, and it turns out the entire, you know, second half of the episode that he experiences as several hours of time was like, you know, 4/1000ths of a second.
Yeah, 0.004, 400th of a second. Yeah.
That's thousands.
Is it? Sorry. Yes. 0.04. It's 100. 100ths, I just read it wrong. I just threw an extra zero in
there. Oh, I thought it was actually 0.004 though.
But it's at least, I don't know, according to Wikipedia, 0.04.
Oh, you're looking at Wikipedia. Okay. Yeah. In that case, 400th of a second. It is the way that sat with me, because there's like you said, there's horror movie stuff that happens. There's a giant spider and he gets stabbed and all these things. And he's not totally sure what's real or whether he's awake or exactly what's going on. And you're not sure watching. But to have it all reduced to 400ths of a second at the end, that just shook me, man, in a deep, like, I think about stuff like that. I think about The Matrix and being locked in your brain and, like, how do you know what's real? Like, that stuff messes me up, and it really got to me.
Interesting. You know, and maybe – I don't know. Maybe
it might be particular to my odd state of mind as a human. But it really – just the idea of having all that experience, like – I don't know. I think a lot about perception in my life and in the world. That example of how technology could lead your own perception to betray you so completely – it is really disturbing to me.
Interesting. I just and maybe this sort of goes back to me sort of viewing this as the most like a horror one. Watching it was super intense, and there was a lot of like it's kind of gripped. But you know, I felt like, you know, no pun intended, that it was the least haunting of all those episodes.
Really?
Yeah, like I felt the opposite. Wow. That it didn't really stay with me a long time. I didn't really see myself in this and what could happen to me, because the idea of implanting a video game in my head, I don't know. It just it seemed not
so
relatable.
Okay. So this is I'm only realizing through this conversation how much this is particular to my state of mind. And like personality, because one of my greatest dreams, one of my greatest hopes and dreams is that before I die, but around the time where I am debilitated and incapacitated, there is a development in video games that allows me in my brain to like play basketball with Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I want the implant so that I can be 79 on my couch and 300 pounds and running up and down the floor with Steph Curry and Klay Thompson.
I got to tell you, this is way side tangent, but our digital department, they got one of those virtual reality, those like goggle things that you wear, you stick that phone into, you know what I'm talking about? And they were playing me the demo of it. And there are, you know, one of the demo scenes, you were actually like practicing with the Cleveland Cavaliers. And so LeBron and Kyrie like run at you in the layup line. It is terrifying. like they're so big and they're coming at you so fast and it's like, whoa. So, I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't be as fun as you think. So all I'm saying, very scary.
Believe me. I have an idea of what it would be like, and I want nothing more in the world.
All right.
But again, it's a video game, so I would be like, I would have the size and skills of, you know, I'd probably make myself essentially the Greek freak. you know? Like, I just want to run point for Jordan and Pippen as a 6'9", lanky Greek man.
Wow. Yeah, I can't think of anything. If I'm going to be in this game, I sure as hell don't want to play with Michael Jordan.
Yeah, I know. You're probably right. I'm just making the point, you know, I'd be LeBron is what I would be, or I'd be Durant right now, you know. But the point is, I want to be able to virtual reality myself into things, and I love the idea of video games advancing to a point where they're perceptively real, if that makes sense. And so, like, the idea, like, people really freaked out about you wave the thing and look, you can bowl and play tennis. That's like a half measure to me. I was never that excited. But if we ever get to the point, like people got excited about the dumb Wii tennis, that's I'll be 10 times that excited for the dumb whack-a-mole game he was playing.
All right.
Like, just the integration of video games into reality and or the ability to create a perceptive reality through a video game is the most tantalizing, like, gaming thing I can imagine by far, and has been for at least 15 years. So thinking about that as much as I do and having the level of excitement for it that I do, and then watching it run horribly awry, and then not only having it go horribly awry, but realizing that the nature of human perception and our brains is such that you can create an entire because think about what that means. You could play an entire video game of basketball in your head in half a second. Less.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it that certainly would be interesting. I'm not doubting that. Does this whole thing, like, not give you a little pause, though, of, like, maybe exactly that's a little too much for your brain?
Maybe. We don't know. And how do we test a thing like that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating to me. And again, the idea of experiencing – because if you can experience a day in 0.04 of a second – how long would it take to experience a lifetime? You could create the perceptive experience of a lifetime in a matter of seconds, in less than a minute.
Yeah,
what if people, and then to realize that could mean ending. I don't know, man. That it's in my brain, as you can see. It's wormed its way deep inside my brain.
It certainly has. This one, like I said, stayed with me less. It did not mean it wasn't any less gripping to watch as it was happening. I certainly had the tight feeling in my stomach.
Oh, man. Well, it might be. It's one of the more – and I think this is because of what you mentioned, and I should not have argued with you that it's the most horror-y. It probably was the most white-knuckle experience of them all for me, in addition to sticking with me afterwards. This one really got – as I said, I watched the first 6 and Christmas special in a, like, 27-hour period or whatever it was.
Yeah.
The fact that I haven't been able to watch another one in 2 weeks since I watched Playtest says something.
Yeah, it does. It does. That one definitely hung. Well, the next one's called Shut Up and Dance. I don't know if there's a Walk the Moon song in it, but I'm going to guess no.
Have you watched it yet?
I watched a portion of it, and then I passed out in the middle.
Yeah, that'll happen.
So I'd really need to go back and watch the whole thing again. The portion that watch was
one
was yikes. Yikes on that one. It's going to be good.
That'll be interesting. I will say that's comparable to the reason we're not going to be able to talk about Westworld this week, which is that I thought it would be a good idea to attempt to watch Westworld after getting back to my hotel room from a Fish concert on Sunday night. And
what world did you end up in? I'm guessing it wasn't Westworld.
What? Say again?
I said, what world did you end up in? Because I'm guessing it wasn't Westworld.
Well, that's what I was going to say is, like, I have memories, but I think it was kind of a weird episode of Westworld. Did you watch it?
No, I'm a little bit behind on the Westworld.
Okay, all right, good, because I think it had to have been a weird episode because I remember some things that do not really make sense with what I had seen before it. But also, I don't know what I don't know what of that was real and if maybe some of it was like dream space. I'm going to have to watch the whole thing over, clearly.
Are you enjoying Westworld more in theory than the abstract? Because I'm starting to feel like I am.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what I said from the beginning. I have a lot of concerns. Mm-hmm. I'm still entertained, and I'm still intrigued. But I definitely have concerns, and I don't know. I'm worried. I'm worried. How's that?
Fair enough. Fair enough. Hey, one more thing before we move on from Black Mirror. This is just trivia that may only interest me. I mentioned this to you yesterday. In playtest, the girl that the main character hooks up there with in London, she's stunning. But you may remember her. She had a small part in the in episode 2, which was the bike episode, 15 Million Merits. She played the girl who got off the bike and became like the singing star on the singing show.
It sounds like you're talking about a stripper.
And like, no, not a stripper. She was the one that sang. She didn't have to strip.
I mean, it's a bike, but no. I mean, got off the bike. Like it sounds like she finally worked her way off the pole.
She got off the pole. She got off the pole. Didn't have to go onto that other pole with I don't know what you call that guy. The Wraith guy. That was his name. Wraith Babes. But she won American Idol basically, and she got to live in a house and wear gold and all that stuff. And I guess they were gonna put her song on the radio in this show, but apparently there was some sort of licensing holdup. They couldn't do it.
I was thinking about that after we talked about it briefly yesterday. How could there be a licensing thing? Isn't that song from the same show?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like Netflix bought the show, they couldn't buy the song in the show.
That's probably how it worked. Actually, yeah. I mean, that's Charlie Brooker was the one that said there's a licensing thing. I feel like he would know.
Yep. He made it.
So. There you go.
It seems like he should not – does not seem like he should have licensing issues with a thing that he made himself.
I feel like we should change laws to really just let him do whatever he wants at this point.
On screen. Don't let him in control of anything in the real world, that's for true. God's sake. That's true. Terrifying.
All right, you mentioned Fish. I wanted to ask you a little bit about a music thing. I went to see Yellow Wolf last night. Can we talk about this for just a brief minute? And then I'm sure you'll have Fish stories for us.
Do you know about Fish's Halloween thing? Quickly,
don't they? Is that the thing where they do a whole album?
Yeah, they have a tradition of a musical costume that more or less means they on a Halloween show, instead of a normal 2-set show, it's a 3-set show, and the middle set they cover an entire album. And that's what I was at, and I would just say. We don't need to talk about it. Apropos of nothing else, this year they did Ziggy Stardust,
mm-hmm.
With a string section and some backup singers. And I would say for you and people like you who aren't necessarily turned on by Fish, but if you have any attachment to that album, which is one of the great albums of all time, they just did a tremendous job of it. I think it's one of the best cover albums they've done in my opinion. I thought it sounded excellent. You know, a couple of the singing choices were out of either necessity or playfulness. I mean, listen, no one can sing like Bowie, and certainly John Fishman doesn't even come close. But the way they were faithful to the music itself, and I think the spirit of the Ziggy Stardust album, which again is just an excellent album if people don't know it, I would recommend giving it a listen. I think it's super cool if you're a Bowie fan at all.
If I'm being honest, you lost me at middle set.
No, I know I did, but what I'm really saying to you, because you have an irrational like negative reaction to like the word Fish and set. A band that is incredibly talented covered one of the great albums of all time in a really respectful, honorific way, and I think you would enjoy it.
I just, yeah, maybe. I don't. It's hard. Just hard for me to imagine a record like that is so dependent on transcendent vocals, and there's not really a transcendent vocalist in that band of talented people. You know what I mean? But I don't know. Maybe it was great. They're great musicians. I'm not trying to knock.
Well, that's the thing. The vocals aren't. It's not Bowie. But nobody's Bowie. I don't know that it matters much who it is if it's not Bowie. And again, that album is iconic well beyond the singing.
I know that
album.
I would have been more interested in seeing them do Purple Rain, to be honest, if they were going to do a 2016. No longer with this guy. I think that could have been really interesting.
I think Bowie's more in the wheelhouse, and actually I think singing Prince is even more absurd.
Fair enough. All right. I went to see Yellow Wolf last night, and I'm not going to say you had quite a similar reaction when I told you that I was going to see Yellow Wolf. As I do when you talk about Fish.
I didn't even disrespect Yellow Wolf, who, relatively speaking, deserves my disrespect.
Go
on.
You did do an audible, oh, God.
I was surprised. There may have been a why in there. I think it was surprise. It was surprise more than it was disgust.
It was definitely noted. Like, oh, you're not going to want to talk about this. I went to the show. And it was one of those, again, that really caught me by surprise. How many people do you think Yellow Wolf is playing to on a Tuesday night in Minneapolis?
2,000?
2,000. All right, fine. That took the sting out of it. 2,000 people.
I nailed it?
Yeah. On a Tuesday night Minneapolis, it was packed. This thing was going nuts. And here's a guy who is...
I mean, there's a lot of white people in Minneapolis.
There are a lot of white people in Minneapolis. But it was a fair... At least for Minneapolis, you got to remember, you got to understand its scale.
A diverse crowd.
A very diverse crowd, yeah. And this guy is blending... he's doing Wu-Tang and Outkast tribute bits and throwing in Seek and Destroy by Metallica. And
what does that mean?
There's elements tribute of country. Bits. What do you mean tribute? I don't know what's the term in hip hop when someone rolls through like eight covers, a medley of 8-10 covers in a row.
I've never seen that in my life.
You've never seen that? I mean, I've seen Tribe Called Quest do that live. You've never seen anybody do that. I've seen tons of people do it now.
You've seen Tribe Called Quest run through covers?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like it's kind of like one song, but they'll be like, they're like, hey, we're gonna do classic hip hop. You chant and sing along, and then they do a bunch of them. Oh yeah, I remember because I saw it. I remember this was like right around the time of Midnight Marauders, I think, was out maybe then, and I remember it quite frankly because
Q-Tip is rapping Tupac verses.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was a little older school than that because it was the mid-90s, so I think it was not Tupac versus. I think it was a little bit more 80s hip-hop versus. But, they were in front of a mostly white crowd, and, like, people didn't know them, which I thought was – that was, like, Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick and, like, that kind of shit.
That's weird.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Maybe I'm being, like, hip-hopist. I don't know why hip-hop artists shouldn't be able to cover people just like rock artists do, but
I'm pretty sure this is the only time that I've seen that. I'm pretty sure I've seen a few people do that sort of thing, maybe I'm wrong. I've certainly been to I've been to more than 10 hip hop shows.
I just don't think I've seen it.
I know, but regardless, like this is a this guy's throwing in a melting pot of things that don't ordinarily necessarily go in a melting pot.
Yeah,
and people
are not. I have no particular distaste for Yellow Wolf. I was surprised that you were going to see him live because that's like a thing that you're spending your time and money on.
Well, not money, but we play some Yellow Wolf on the station, and we have a lot of fans in the 93X music department of Yellow Wolf. So, I wanted to go check it out. And as I told you before, I think the last time I saw him play a radio show, the other thing that I sort of enjoy about his shows is that he's generally not sober, and you have oftentimes have no idea what he's going to do. And
I can get down with that. I love the surprise.
That's really rare, I feel like, in a concert experience now. where you legitimately don't know what's going to happen. Now, he did not set his mic on fire like he did the last time I saw him.
That's another point in Fish's favor,
and he did not lead the crowd in an a cappella version of Friends in Low Places like the last time I saw him. But he did organize this like one mosh pit thing that was ridiculously crazy. Where I was in the balcony, so I was fine, but I was genuinely concerned for the safety of some at the show. And then there were a couple of other sort of random moments where you felt like maybe things might go off the tracks a little bit. It was a wholly enjoyable experience for me. And so really my only question to you is, I do recognize that this guy's kind of uncool, but I don't really understand why that is. And I thought
it's
more of a hip-hop aficionado, I would throw that out to you. Why is Yellow Wolf uncool?
I don't know what uncool means. I don't think Yellow Wolf is a particular talent. But again, I'm not an expert. I haven't dug in. I'm not particularly interested in like country rap rock. So he's not someone I've investigated. Like I said, I don't think he's a particular talent necessarily, and I don't know that he's saying anything interesting or doing anything especially interesting musically with his own stuff.
But I
should say I truly don't know. When I say I don't know that he is, that's somewhat a reaction to Reputation and somewhat I just haven't heard anything.
Right.
I haven't heard
much. And that's kind of what I'm getting at. Like, I don't feel like this guy has a good reputation. I mean, he's got bona fides. This is a guy signed by Eminem. He's definitely got some flow and some talent. And I think his thing is I don't feel like he's posing at all. You know what I mean? Which I think is the thing that people want to tag on him because he's a white rapper. You know what I mean?
Obviously, the white rapper part doesn't bother me. I think the country rapper part makes me go kind of meh.
Yeah, I just, and look, I'm not a big country fan either, but I feel like his thing is a really interesting synthesis of that. The band's out, he goes out with a DJ and a guy who plays some guitar and some piano. And it's a full sound. I would encourage you to just see him live one time and see if that changes your perception at all. I have a feeling you might be surprised.
Yeah, I might be. Also, like, I don't... never mind. I shouldn't say that.
Now I really want to know where it's going. I'm just saying, if you
it was gonna be about the Yellow Wolf crowd.
If you find him at a festival,
right?
Maybe that's the thing to do.
I'm not ruling out going and checking it out at a festival.
Look,
I have no opposition to Yellow Wolf. I think that's clear. I just don't. I'm not attracted to it. For any reason.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It's like the way I think the way you're like, it's kind of the way I am with like Fish. I'm like, I just, that crowd. I don't know if I want to be in that crowd.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that makes me sad though, that you want to be in a Yellow Wolf crowd and not in a Fish crowd.
Well,
like
I don't.
It makes me feel like you're misunderstanding one of the crowds. Or one of us is drastically misunderstanding one of the crowds.
I suppose that's fair. I am going to not delineate the difference there because I'm just going to not get myself in trouble, I think.
I don't think there's any reason to dig it a hole any deeper than we already have at this point.
I did think that was an interesting moment. Like I said, that's the other thing is like you don't go to many shows where you feel like this guy has his own culture going on there. And maybe it's not my culture, you know what I mean? But it's unique. Right. And I don't know, I appreciated
both
that.
Of those groups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd recommend the Yellow Wolf experience, even if it's kind of a sociological thing where you're just going to see who's at the show. That's also the kind of thing I do as a music programmer is like, I really like to go to shows and just see
who's listening to what.
Yeah. Who's at the show and how are they enjoying it? Even if I'm not interested at all, I can be interested in that. You know what I mean? So
totally.
So yeah, that's a, it does also define a lot of the way I watch shows. All right, season one of Atlanta is now done. Sad times.
Oh man,
I know.
I don't understand why we need 25 episodes of The New Girl, which is a show I like but is clearly overexposed, and only 10 episodes of Atlanta. It makes me angry.
Well, some of that is commerce, and I think that you would not feel the same way about Atlanta if they had to make 25 episodes just from a production schedule thing. Yeah, 25 episodes in a year, I think. I mean, obviously, at some point, they'll probably have 25 episodes of the show.
Okay, but you couldn't get me to, like, 16, man? I mean, there was a real emptiness inside me as the show ended last night. Even though I love the ending so much, I thought it was so true to the to what the show has been. Are we going to spoil it? There's not really much to spoil.
Yeah, no. Go ahead, spoil it.
It does such a great job of something that I think maybe people lost a little bit over the course of watching it because of some of the surreality and wild originality of it, which is that it's about a guy who's just like trying to do his best. And it ends with him maybe doing a little better, but maybe not, and really just still trying to figure it out. But I don't know. It felt so faithful to all the characters. Sort of the entire last episode of Donald Glover looking for a jacket that you don't totally understand why he's so interested in it, and ultimately ending up sleeping in a storage container, but like holding a little more cash than he expected, and like maybe things are happening, maybe they're not. I don't know. It just feels like life, right?
Yeah,
that's what it is to me.
Minus the storage container part, hopefully. but yeah, it was.
Well, I mean, it's not my life, but it is the life of this character that we started knowing in the first minute of the series.
Yeah,
you know, who is this guy that? There's still a lot we don't know, but we know he's smart. We know he comes from a family that is not wealthy, but is not homeless, but that he sort of, for whatever reason, has chosen a life of barely keeping it together.
Yeah.
Or has ended up in a place where he's barely keeping it together because of surprising decisions he's made. And yet now he really does seem to be trying. And you know, Van says it to him in the episode is like, yeah, you're kind of all messed up, but you know what? Like you're a good father, and like you're trying is the message there to me. That's how this series, this season anyway, that seems so out there in so many ways. That's how it makes, I think, anyone, any thinking person who watches it, that's where it drags you in and says, no, this is you.
Yeah. I mean, look, it balances the absurd with the real and the personal.
Personal. Yeah.
In such an artful way that it's really hard not to be charmed by it.
Yeah. Like when he walks away from Van's house, which for a second I thought was going to be the final shot of the episode. But when he's walking away and he's like, yeah, I'll call you tomorrow. And it's like, because there's a moment there where a lot of shows and movies and narratives in general, he does stay at over there. Or he turns around and goes back in or whatever, you know, and it's like, oh, everything's going to be okay. He figured it out. And maybe that's more of an end of series moment than an end of season moment. But Atlanta just feels too much like life to do stuff like that. And I love that about it.
Yeah, too much like life, except like, you know, then what happens with the jacket is crazy and hilarious, you know.
Yes. And well, that brings me back to something that I feel like I brought up on this podcast maybe last week or the week before, which is the Tim O'Brien, the things they carried idea of sometimes the truthiest thing is a story, right? Sometimes the thing that rings the most true, sometimes you have to tell a lie to tell the truth, as it were, or make up a story to tell the truth. And that's what Atlanta is to me. Even the surreality, it's about showing truth in a way that's important, even when it's telling fantastical stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a show. It does feel very true. I do wonder, you know, if we get, you know, how many shows have we seen that have had a great freshman season? You know, it's kind of like how many bands make a great first album and then, you know, you get 6 months to make an album number two and, you know, it turns out to be lesser.
I hope not.
That, you know, and that's just the thought of, you know, I don't want it to be over, and I wish there was another one to watch next Tuesday, but you do wonder, it's like, hopefully they'll be able to keep this thing going and it won't be season two of Mr. Robot, you know?
Yeah. Agreed.
Speaking of which, and maybe this is partly what got me thinking about it, you know, there was an interesting episode of You're the Worst this weekend, which is a show we talked about from time to time. I didn't love this episode, and I feel like it's somewhat endemic of the series kind of floundering a little bit.
I think this is when we had our 3-minute pre-show preparation meeting. This was why I thought it made a good transition from Atlanta, is because Atlanta had an episode middle of the season where Van and her friend had dinner. And that was basically the whole episode. And so it's two female, different sex characters who are distinctly not the main characters of the show, one of whom is barely a character on the show, having their own experience, and it felt completely authentic. It felt like an indelible part of the Atlanta universe. And You're the Worst has this episode that is two dudes, but, you know, still like a change in sexual makeup of the versus the main characters, who is a guy and a girl. And people that are essentially peripheral to the story, more than essentially peripheral, in fact, essentially minor characters. And it spent the whole time with them, and it felt forced and not that interesting. And it had a couple of cheap laughs that I enjoyed, but like, it felt out of place from the You're the Worst universe. It felt like a bottle episode in a way that was totally separate from the show, almost like a spinoff or a backdoor pilot or something. And I agree, it just didn't, even if I laughed a few times, it just didn't connect.
Yeah, I think the point you're making is true for the show, and also not true in that they did do a bottle episode with a minor character with Edgar earlier in the season that I thought was very successful.
Well, that was my point. It's not a statement about You're the Worst in general necessarily. It's more a statement about how delicate these sorts of balances are. And I think You're the Worst, interestingly enough, so we talked about this last year, but the first season was just almost a sort of Always Sunny in Philadelphia type of feel. Just horrible people doing horrible things in a hilarious way, right?
Right.
The second season was super intense and got very serious about depression. And I think – I believe we more or less agreed that they did it in a pretty successful way. Right. Right?
And I think while that was going on, I think they certainly fleshed out the lead characters somewhat. And I think fleshed out Edgar's character a little bit more. Lindsay kind of remains a cartoon.
Yeah.
Although they've tried this year to do a little less of that. Go ahead,
just
sorry.
Quickly, though, to finish off that point is this is a show that's clearly – it's made by a very talented guy in Stephen Falk, and clearly is well acted and well put together and does a lot of smart, interesting things. And yet that razor's edge of continuing to feel true and honest and good as it did in its first two seasons, despite sort of changing the content in a pretty significant way, it's struggled this season to do that. And that's where I'm saying maybe your fears about Atlanta are somewhat founded, is that even for someone very talented who's done it very successfully multiple times, it's a tough line to walk.
Yep.
It's hard to keep going. And You're the Worst is another one that it's short seasons. It's hard to keep bringing that much truth to what are essentially just people's lives on a television show season after season. It's not easy.
Yeah, I agree. We celebrate people nailing this balance because it's really effing hard, even for people who can do it. And so, yeah, so I do, I do worry that, you know, I mean, it's easy to look at season one of Atlanta as like a perfect album, you know what I mean? Or a near perfect album. Right. And, you know, I mean, you don't know you're going to get that the next time around. Yeah. So, so let's enjoy it while we can, you know?
Yeah.
Cause there are plenty of great shows that, remain good or watchable, but don't stay great. You know, that's the tends to be the nature of things. So, let's appreciate it while we can. And that seems like, I'm going to say probably a good note to wrap this thing up on. What do you think?
Yeah, I guess we won't get to Bill Simmons then.
Yeah.
But that's fine. We can put that off.
Bill Simmons. No one will be watching Bill Simmons next week, and we can talk about that then too.
I, if you can, I would like you to watch a few.
Okay.
Of the recent ones,
I will. I will try. They've now been piling up on my DVR, which I think says a lot, considering that I have been Team Bill Simmons from literally the time that since he was before he was ready for ESPN.
But you're not Team Bill Simmons now.
No,
you just stopped watching the TV show.
Yes, and reading the website.
You don't read The Ringer?
I don't read The Ringer, but yeah, Grantland was like my homepage.
Like Grantland.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like Grantland, that was open every day all the time. Now if I see something, we're already getting into it. But
let's make this homework. In addition to episode 3 of Black Mirror, of the new Black Mirror, let's each try to look at The Ringer every day. And maybe read at least one thing and watch a couple of Any Given Wednesdays. I would really recommend just the most two recent ones. And there's a new one tonight. But the most two recent ones, there was Vince Staples, Al Michaels, and Bob Costas. And then it was Larry Wilmore and then the pairing of Bill Burr and Wayne Gretzky.
Okay. I may watch that one. I've had enough of Vince Staples. I just have.
Really?
Especially, yeah. The Ringer really wants to make Vince Staples happen, and I'm good, man. I'm good.
I kind of like Vince Staples, but putting that aside, you should watch. You should if you're sick of Vince Staples, just skip the Vince Staples part. You have to watch the Michaels and Costas.
All right.
And I would also say the extra time with Michaels and Costas. That entire discussion. I'm asking you to specifically watch that.
All right, I'll check that out, and then of course, Shut Up and Dance, episode of Black Mirror. That's
Black
also homework
Mirror.
As well.
And I will try to watch it without totally breaking down.
Or singing Walk the Moon.
Yeah, yeah. Yikes.
I loved your horror at that thought. It was really great. All right. I think that's going to do it for this week. We'll talk at you soon.
Bye-bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.